I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. In 2018, Missouri voters made medical marijuana legal. Since then, the state has issued licenses to 192 dispensaries and has started accepting applications from residents hoping to qualify for cannabis treatment. Today, we'll learn how to get a medical marijuana card and what you can do with one once you have it. We'll also find out how the state plans to monitor the program and prevent abuse. Then, Missouri's two historically black universities are facing dire financial insecurity. We'll find out how the schools adapt to a razor-thin budget and how the shortfall affects students and staff. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The Missouri Department of Health and Senior Services has awarded licenses to 192 medical marijuana dispensaries throughout the state. That was the minimum number provided for by a new constitutional amendment on medical marijuana that Missouri voters approved in 2018. Question is, how will Missouri get medical marijuana to people who need it, and how will the state keep it away from those who don't? Now, a conversation with the state's new medical marijuana czar about how all this is going to work. With us, Lindahl Fraker is director of medical marijuana in Missouri. He's a former state representative. And Lindahl, thanks for joining us again. I appreciate it.
You bet, Steve. Thank you for having me.
Dr. George Edwards is here. He's an interventional pain management specialist. Dr. Edwards, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Lindahl, how many Missourians have successfully applied for and received medical marijuana cards here?
We're right at 35,000 patients now that have received their medical marijuana card.
And is that roughly what you expected, or more or less, or...
Well, quite frankly, it's right on line, right on target, and right in line with what the drafters of the amendment and those that had been involved in the industry in other states told us initially. They thought it'd be about a 2-3% adoption rate of our state population, which would be an average of about 150,000 patients after 3 years. So we think we're right on line, right on track with that.
I'm wondering what your latest thinking is as to when these folks will be able to go to dispensaries and that have been awarded licenses here to, you know, to actually pick up a supply of medical marijuana.
We think that we have some cultivation facilities that are getting really close to requesting their commencement walkthrough, which would allow them to go ahead and begin growing the product. So if that occurs in the next few weeks, then, you know, you're looking at about a 90 to 120-day gestation period for those plants to be able to get to dispensaries. And so we could be looking at maybe sometime in the summer.
Sometime this summer, midsummer, mm-hmm. early summer, any sense yet?
I think the earliest would be probably June, July.
Okay. Well, Dr. Edwards, what kind of help does medical marijuana provide patients? What remedies does it offer here?
Well, when you talk to different patients, there's a variety of conditions that they'll use it for: chronic muscle pain, just pain in general, degenerative joint disease, intractable headaches, migraines, and then epilepsy. We've seen patients with cancer. Hmm. It's the full gamut of medical conditions.
Why does it work? What do we know about that?
That's the million-dollar question. I mean, there's all kinds of studies. Because it was classified as a Schedule I drug up until recently, it hasn't been federally allowed. You couldn't investigate it. And so now, within the last, say, 10 years, there's more and more investigation going on. Why it specifically works, they know there's receptors in the brain, there's receptors in the other body organs, let's say the GI system, joint, muscles. It has some interaction with that. It's a neurotransmitter, so it affects that in some way.
We're not talking about cures here. We're talking about relief from pain, generally speaking?
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay. What do we know at this point about how much medical marijuana is going to cost in the state?
I don't know that they've put that out. Realistically, it's probably going to have to be competitive with what patients buy it on the street. Mm-hmm. The majority of patients that I see, probably 70%, are using marijuana, if not daily, throughout. They're using it regularly through a week. And unfortunately, because it's not available yet legally, they're buying it from their friend or someone that they know. And so it's going to have to be competitive with that price.
Who's going to set the price, Lindahl?
Well, that will be determined by the market. We do not have the authority, and it wasn't in the Constitution for us to get involved in the pricing.
So each individual dispensary then will sort of make that determination on its own?
Yes, it'll be somewhat of a free market on the pricing. I'm sure a lot of that will probably start off at least based on what other states and what the price is in other states and neighboring states, certainly.
You know, Lindahl, you've awarded 192 licenses to dispensaries around the state. I mentioned that in the opening here. There's some thinking that you'll eventually award more. Is that the case?
The Constitution gives us the authority to do that. It also set these initial amounts, quantities, based on population, based on what they felt like the adoption rate would be and other criteria. So it wasn't just numbers they pulled out of the air. And the Constitution is very clear that we may issue more based on the needs of the patients of Missouri. So we want to see how it goes with getting these initial quantities set up.
So you want to see how it goes and then sort of review it at some point later on this summer or this fall?
I can't tell you, give you a time frame when. We certainly know that it's going to be probably a year before most all the facilities are up and running. So we'll just have to see.
Dr. Edwards, what makes medical marijuana different from recreational marijuana?
Well, it's the same plant. The advantage will be is that everything that's in a dispensary will be tested. So you'll know the quality, be able to look at the percentage of both THC and CBD. You'll get a known product that then once you find the dose or the specific strain that works for you, you can buy that on a consistent basis.
And what patients can pick up, doctor, will have a lower THC component than regular recreational marijuana. Do I have that right?
No, that's actually probably what they'll be able to buy in a dispensary will be even a higher percentage of THC. You don't know what you're getting when you're buying it illegally or off the street.
Help me there. I thought what you could sell in a dispensary would have a limited THC component to it.
And I don't think there's that provision. If you look at what other states have, say Colorado or Nevada, where there's recreational, the percentage can vary quite a bit from anywhere from probably 15 up to 25 to 28%.
Mm-hmm.
And you can pick and choose with what you want.
Lindahl, are we hearing that correctly? Again, THC is the ingredient that makes people feel high after smoking marijuana.
Yes, the doctor's correct. There's no limits in the Missouri Constitution, the amendment that was passed by the voters. The THC content can be any amount, and it is important, though, as he mentioned, that we make sure the product's tested, and that's certainly all spelled out in there, and that the content, the THC content and other ingredients are all tested and made sure that they are what they are supposed to be. So that's one reason our program is going to be very highly regulated.
And will each product be labeled as to its THC content, Lindahl, so people know what they're buying?
Absolutely.
Yeah. How much marijuana will people be able to get at a time, each month?
4 ounces of flowering product is what it's allowed is what is allowed in the Constitution per 30 days.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one caveat with that. It also said that if a second doctor's opinion deemed that this particular patient might need more, they would be allowed an additional 4 ounces. So 8 ounces would be the max, but that would take 2 doctor's certifications. And, of course, that would probably be only in extreme circumstances, terminally ill patients with severe pain, things of that nature.
Dr. Edwards, what do you make of the 4-ounce-a-month limit?
I think that's sufficient for most people. Of all the folks I've seen very few that would require it more than that.
And, Lindahl, people will be allowed to grow their own, and I'm wondering why.
Well, that was another piece put in the amendment, I think, probably to help get it across the finish line. You have a lot of patients out there that maybe the cost of coming through a dispensary might be prohibitive for them to be able to afford it. So the drafters put that part in there where the patients, if they purchase a cultivation card, which would be subscribed by us, then they would be able to grow up to 6 flowering plants in the home.
But there are pretty strict guidelines attached here, aren't there, when it comes to growing on your own? And what are some of those?
Yes, sir. Certainly, they have to be. It has to be done in a very secure location, only accessible by the patient or a patient's caregiver, which is another part of the program. A caregiver can be allowed to to grow or to help take care of a patient. It has to be, you know, again, secure. It can't be visible to the public. So it could be outside or in a backyard or something, but it would have to be, you know, obscured where the public couldn't see it. And it can only be done or used or accessed by the patient or caregiver, no one else.
Your questions about how you can take advantage of Missouri's new medical marijuana law are allowed and welcome right now. 816-235-2888 is our number, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Dr. George Edwards, what are the health risks associated with marijuana?
Well, the ones that's probably most commonly talked about is particularly those who smoke. It has the same concerns if you're smoking a tobacco product. I mean, all the reactive airways, asthma, leading to COPD, cancer. So if you can eliminate that and use and consume it in other forms, then you've eliminated probably the biggest health risk. Mm-hmm. And then one that I always discuss with folks, anyone under the age of 25, you have to talk about brain development because our brain's still developing up to that point. Women of childbearing age, you have to discuss with them about if they get pregnant, they should stop, just like they should stop smoking cigarettes. Those are probably the biggest concerns. And then you start talking about other things like interaction with medications, absorption, metabolism, those kind of factors.
Yeah, you know, I'm wondering, doctor, for patients who are waiting for legalized marijuana to come up for sale, what options do they have?
Well, like I'd mentioned, there's a lot of folks who are obtaining it illegally. So that would be solved once it is available. You can, once you have your Missouri card, file to get a temporary card in other states. Currently, probably Arkansas and Oklahoma are the closest. Mm-hmm. You can then go and purchase there. Now, unfortunately, it's still illegal to bring it back across a state line, but that is an option for some. And now that Illinois has recreational, you can take your Missouri card to Illinois, and I've heard on Mondays they will allow Missouri medical marijuana patients to obtain it there on Mondays only.
Hmm. What do you make of that, Lindahl? Is that complicate things or not?
Well, we are trying to follow what the Constitution says and the voters voted on, and certainly, if you have a home grow card, then you would be able to go ahead and grow in the home at this time before the dispensaries are ready. So I think that would be the most logical way for anyone to go ahead and get product at this time.
So, Lindahl, to qualify to get a medical marijuana card, what do Missourians have to do?
They have to apply to our department, and then they have to be certified by a physician, a medical doctor, MD, or DO, doctor of osteopathy, that are in good standing, registered in the state of Missouri, and have been residents of Missouri for a year. That's really the main criteria. And then once that doctor certifies and it's submitted back with the patient application, we do a very minimal amount of background check on the patient, and then generally they'll be approved.
So it's up to the doctors to make this determination. How much latitude do they have?
They really have all of the latitude. The Missouri program was drafted and set up that way. In some states, the regulating agency would have to certify a doctor to be able to certify patients. And in our state, it was not set up that way. It was basically left up to the doctor. It's their license that is on the line, so to speak. They report to the Board of Healing Arts, and so they oversee the doctors in Missouri, and we don't interfere with that relationship. It is a doctor-patient relationship program, and that was pretty clear in the amendment.
Dr. Edwards, how ready, how prepared are doctors to make this determination? What's your sense?
There are not a lot of physicians who want to do this.
Oh, they really? Why?
I think they may be their personal bias on marijuana. They may be limited, particularly if they're employed physicians with some of the larger health groups. They specifically have been told that they cannot participate with it. I think there's some concern, and I think it's unfounded, about if you do have any interaction with marijuana, will that affect your ability to get federally funded money like for Medicare? Hmm. So a lot of docs that I've talked with have specifically avoided it.
So what are people doing then who feel they need a medical marijuana card? Is word spreading on the street as to which doctors are the ones to go to get this approved?
Well, you can go to your personal physician and ask them. Since I've practiced in this area for 30 years, I've gone to all the docs that I knew when I was in practice, and so they send me their folks. They know I would see them, so I'm a good referral source for those folks.
Mm-hmm.
And there's others like that. You can go on websites. There's different websites you can look at.
Hey, to what extent do you think people, patients, potential patients, are being straight up with you about what their condition is, or are they coming in just saying, hey, I'm struggling with depression. I think I need a card.
Well,
whether they are or yeah, not struggling with depression.
The state's been very good about it, and they require us to verify a medical condition. So we obtain records. We pre-screen folks before they even come to our office. So as I talk with them, if I'm hearing what they're telling me and it's not going to qualify, I'm up front with them and say, you shouldn't even bother. Don't waste your time or money. So we obtain medical records, and so when a patient comes in, we've reviewed those records. We complete a history and physical exam. So we think we have a pretty good sense of who would qualify and who would not.
Yeah. But again, what's the chances that someone can mislead you about their situation?
Well, if we've got records that we can verify from their primary or specialty physician, then you would think that that'd be minimal.
Mm-hmm.
We review pharmacy records to make sure they're on the medications that they tell us they're taking. So at least from my practice, I think I screen those patients out. I feel comfortable that I'm doing what the state wants.
Lindahl, what's the state's role in preventing people from falsifying conditions here to get a medical marijuana card?
Again, reviewing that certification form, making sure that the certification is done by a legitimate doctor, one that met all that criteria that I mentioned to you. Certainly, we understand that there's probably doctors that don't do it as well as what Dr. Edwards does. But as long as they follow the criteria and they, again, their license is under the purview of the Board of Healing Arts, and certainly any issues that might come up, that they can do an investigation or they can follow up and make sure the doctors are doing what they're supposed to do.
Medical marijuana in Missouri is our topic. Our phone number, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Ken pointed out to us on Twitter this morning that many folks in Missouri got growers' licenses and are actively growing and sharing with other patients. The state has taken way too long to implement this. Those who got their prescription cards in August 2019 will have to renew their card again after just 1 month of use. What about that, Lindahl?
We followed the Constitution. We had actually five constitutional deadlines, dates that we had to meet. We met all five of those, and it was a very rigorous time frame that we had to meet to be able to get the program, even to get the patient cards ready to go by July the 4th, which was the constitutional date. We made that a week early, June the 28th. And then all of the business licenses that application process didn't begin until August the 4th. So this was set up by design by the drafters and voted on by the voters. We've felt very much pressure meeting those deadlines, and that's what we've done. So we're working it as fast as we can, believe it or not.
You know, the research here, Dr. Edwards, is pretty limited in terms of what we know about the impact that marijuana has on medical conditions. The only proven use is for a few kinds of epilepsy. Can doctors approve the medical use of marijuana for anything they deem worthy? Again, I think we've covered this a little bit, whether there's evidence of a medical necessity or not?
Yes.
Yeah, there's no question about it.
Right.
And are there qualifying medical conditions that you're looking for?
Sure. I mean, there's some specific ones, things like epilepsy, cancer, intractable migraine headaches, glaucoma. But then there's fairly broad categories like a chronic medical condition that causes persistent pain or muscle spasm, or any other chronic condition that causes debilitating conditions for the patient. So those are fairly wide open that would be very inclusive.
You know, Lindahl, there's a seed-to-sale tracking system that Missouri is going to be employing here. What is that exactly?
That is actually, you might call it an inventory control system. Those of us that have been in retail in the past would understand that. The product will be tracked and traced as the plants are started in the cultivation facilities. A batch number will be assigned, and that batch number will follow that plant all the way through the end, all the way to the patient's home. So we'll be able to keep track of the product in Missouri and monitor where it's going and that making sure people are doing what they're supposed to be doing. And, of course, this will apply to that 4-ounce per 30-day limit also. It'll help us to track that.
Well, given that, how well is all this going over in rural Missouri?
Well, I think it's going over quite well. I've made 128 presentations since January the 2nd of last year around the state.
Got that thing down by now?
Well, we have to update it frequently, but yes, we've made a point to be very transparent, very open, very receiving as we were building the rules, which had to be done by June the 4th last year, and we wanted to make sure everyone had a chance to give us their input. Now, everyone's not going to agree with every decision we make, but we believe that the citizens of Missouri wanted a very well-regulated, safe industry, and that's what we're trying to do. This is not the Wild Wild West. Some states have more of that type of procedure, but we don't believe that's what Missourians voted on, and so we're trying to follow that. And rural Missouri has been very receptive. I believe, you know, in my county, Webster County down in southwest Missouri, kind of the buckle of the Bible Belt, you know, Amendment 2 passed with a 58% margin, so not quite as strong as the whole state, but I think citizens all across Missouri are ready for that well-regulated program.
You know, are patients' registration status going to be publicly available, Lindell?
Absolutely not. That is very clear in the Constitution. We are not to
doctor-patient relationship there,
yes,
that
sir.
Kind of thing?
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Let's go to some phone calls here before we end this segment. Fred from Ray County, good morning.
Hello.
Hi.
My wife, who's physically disabled, requires opiate painkillers, and she goes to a painkiller clinic out in Shawnee, Kansas. And they have told her that if she goes to medical marijuana, she could no longer be prescribed opiates. I'd like some clarification on this. Is this federal law superseding what they can do, or is this just something they want to do on the side? Like I say, they're on the Kansas side. It's really hard to find anybody who will prescribe opiates for painkillers anymore. Hmm. And that's our problem right here, is if she goes to medical marijuana, they say they'll cut her off.
Dr. Edwards, right, weigh in here, would you?
That's probably the individual opinion or the decision of that practice. In Kansas, it's going to be illegal. Mm-hmm. We faced the same problem in Missouri when it was illegal, so we were limited. We didn't have a patient on medical marijuana and prescribe them opioids. Now that it's legal in Missouri, that's changed, but it's still the individual decision by that practice.
Yeah. How about whether Missouri, Lindell, will accept medical cards from other states?
We call that reciprocity, and it was not built into our Constitution. So, no. We will not. Mm-hmm.
Stacy from Kansas City, Missouri. Stacy, you're on the air.
I just had a question. I don't know if this is true, but is it true that if they have a card, that they then cannot purchase firearms in Missouri?
The phone bleeped. You're talking about firearms, right?
Yeah, they have a card. They cannot purchase a firearm in Missouri. Is that true?
Lindell, is that true?
I don't want to speak for the federal government. The federal government are the ones that oversee the movement of firearms in our nation. I will tell you that on the federal 4473 form that you would fill out if you went to buy a new firearm from a registered dealer, that there are some questions on there that ask if you use marijuana, drugs. I'm not sure the specifics about the questions, but I believe that you'd certainly be perjuring yourself if you had a medical marijuana card or you used the product and you answered that form incorrectly.
So it sounds like you're saying the answer is potentially, Lindell, if I'm hearing you right.
Yes, I would recommend that they, if they, you know, had a concern with that, they check with their local law enforcement authorities. Typically, the sheriff's departments have a lot of that information and certainly make sure that they know what they're doing with that.
We're going to have to leave our conversation right there. Stacy, thank you for the call. I want to thank Lindell Fraker, Director of Medical Marijuana in Missouri, for coming in and answering our questions again. Lindell, I sure appreciate your patience with us. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate you inviting me.
You bet. Dr. George Edwards is also with us, an interventional pain management specialist. Dr. Edwards, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
After a short break, we'll come back and talk about the challenges facing historically black colleges in Missouri. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Tomorrow on Up to Date, the 19th Amendment gave women the right to vote. A year after it became law, the League of Women Voters was founded. We'll learn a little more about that history and about the work the League is doing locally, even today. Well, historically, black colleges in Missouri know something about overcoming challenges. They endure despite serving a population of students who largely come from tough financial circumstances. They endure despite a state funding that's not on par with funding for other state universities. And they endure even if they can't afford to hire full-time faculty and are forced to rely on part-timers. Now a conversation about the purpose of these schools and how they're managing in such a difficult financial climate. With us, Dr. Dwayne Smith is interim president at Harris Stowe State University. That's over in St. Louis. Dr. Smith, thanks for taking some time. I appreciate it.
You're quite welcome. And now, thank you for having me.
In this day and age, why is there a need for black colleges and universities?
That's a simple question to respond to. When you think about diversity in colleges and universities in America, HBCUs play an integral role in diversifying those individuals who go to higher education. So take it, this, put this in perspective, only about 3% of African Americans attend HBCUs, but they produce 19% of all African Americans who graduate from higher education. To put in another perspective, over 50% of all doctors, African American doctors, receive their undergraduate degree from HBCU. So it's important, particularly as we open up the highway, if you will, of those individuals who want to seek higher education, that HBCUs are here for all types of learners.
What should I take away from that, what those stats you just threw out?
That means that we are, as a group, we are producing the leaders of today with minimum funding. And so if you look across the nation, HBCUs, particularly public ones, are not on par in terms of funding with their PWIs, or predominantly white institutions, their counterparts. And so at Harris Stowe, you know, we're one of the public institutions, HBCUs, but we have the lowest funding, the total amount of appropriation of any HBCU in the country.
Does uncertainty over the need for your schools, does it in some ways undermine your argument to state lawmakers that you deserve more funding?
Well, since it's not even more funding, it's equitable funding. Okay. And so if you look at historically Harris Stowe, we came into the system, the state system in 1979. And you know, we've been established. We were established in 1857. So we're the oldest teacher education institution west of the Mississippi. But when we came into the system in 1979, our funding was $1.7 million. So we were to run an entire institution on $1.7 million. And so currently now our funding appropriation is about $10 million. So we've had some increases over the years, but it has not kept up with the total needs of the institution. So it's not more funding. It's funding that's going to allow us to be on par with our sister institutions.
Why is your funding not on par with your sister institutions? What's going on with that?
Well, again, I think when you look at the inception of Harris Stowe coming into the system, you have $1.7 million to run an institution. But then, you know, there were increases. And then, of course, across the board, there hasn't been substantial funding for any of the public institutions. But again, when you start at a deficit, it's just very hard to catch up over the years, particularly when you look at funding cuts over the years and stagnant funding for higher education in Missouri. You have what you have here, that we have about $10.5 million, and that really was an infusion by the state. We were at one point at $9-some-odd million at 2003 funding levels.
There's this fundamental issue when it comes to how the state funds your schools. In reading about this, you're funded at a 50% level compared to the 100% level at the University of Missouri. Can you explain what that means to us?
Well, I think that it's a little bit more complicated than that. So basically, schools are funded. There's really no funding standard. Just basically, we get about maybe 1-point-some-odd percent of the budget. And then, of course, the University of Missouri system is a much larger institution, so they get a lion's share of that. But I guess the funding does not take into consideration what it takes to educate a student. So You look at various opportunities that schools have to educate their students. So usually you have appropriation, tuition, fees, you have auxiliary, those different, and endowments. And unfortunately for Harrisville, the methods that we have for the education of our students would be our tuition as well as our state funding.
But what should I read into the fact that black schools in this state are funded at such a disproportionately lower rate than other state schools?
Well, you know, I am always optimistic that once individuals hear the story, hear the success of Harris Stowe, what we do for students, that there will be a willingness to increase the funding, equitable funding to Harris Stowe. So, for example, Harris Stowe has the highest number of Pell-eligible students in the country. You know, the average for African-Americans in higher education is about 73%. At Harris Stowe, it's almost 90%. So, of course, we're a diverse campus. We have all different ethnic groups there, but we have the highest number of students who depend on Pell, and that is a barometer for income. So we're mm-hmm. saying low-income individuals. And then we have the largest number of individuals who are first generation, the first in their family mm-hmm. to attend college. So when you combine those two, it's a challenge to educate those students. And so my goal as the interim president is to be a champion for Harris Stowe and what we do, and how when what we do is so critical for the livelihood for the state of Missouri. Mm-hmm. And once people hear that, once legislators hear that, they're open to funding Harris Stowe for our different initiatives.
So your school does accept students who are white, who are Hispanic?
Of course, yeah. So that's a misnomer. So basically, the first schools that integrated in America were HBCUs.
Huh.
And so you look at Harris Stowe. Harris Stowe is about 85% African American and 15% white, Hispanic, Native American. And so if you look at, flip those numbers and those percentages at other our sister institutions, you would not find that type of diversity. But if you move even forward to that, you look at the diversity of our faculty. You know, we have probably one of the most diverse faculties in the state of Missouri, staff, administration, even the Board of Regents. We are a diverse campus that happens to be an HBCU. But also I'll just add that the economic impact that we make on the region is profound. So each year, Harris Stowe, our impact is $65 million per year. Consider the fact that we get $10 million for the state. That's really a nice mm-hmm. Impact. And then if you look at our students who are first generation, low income, it's been estimated that their lifetime career earnings is about $1.3 billion over the four classes that we graduated. And those are individuals who will stay in the state of Missouri. They will stay in the St. Louis region. So that those are taxpaying citizens. And so when people are educated about what we do, I think that it becomes a no-brainer that we need to be funded for our endeavors.
We're talking about historically black colleges and universities in Missouri. What is the advantage for an African-American to attend your school compared, you know, to a traditional four-year institution like, say, UMKC or Mizzou?
Well, I think that one of the wonderful things about higher education that there's access. And so I've been in higher education for 36 years and worked at every institutional type in Missouri. And now my career is at Harris Stowe, so I'm not here to prop Harris Stowe over any institution. It's a matter of preference. But I would say this is that a student will come to Harris Stowe and they have even though we're funded as we are, they have the same opportunity to be successful, to have a career than students that will go to our other sister institutions. So, for example, we have one of our students, Derek McFarland. He's from East St. Louis. And he is interested in STEM, and he will be graduating. But he recently won a nationwide undergraduate STEM competition. And this was held in Washington, D.C. And he competed with other students from some of the top schools in the nation. But the other part of this is he's been accepted to the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana. That is their flagship institution. And he's got a full fellowship to go into a PhD program. We're not talking about a master's program. We're saying right out of Harris Stowe, he's going to go into one of the top PhD programs in the country.
Hmm.
And so when you ask Derek, what's the advantage of coming, going to Harris Stowe? He would say that I've had tremendous advantages. I've had opportunities to connect with scholars, with faculty members, with my fellow peers. And so I would say that there are advantages to attending Harris Stowe. It's more than meet the eye. I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
What's your enrollment these days, doctor, and what's the trend? Is it going up or going down?
Oh, it's going up. So we're at 1,700 students, and we've had double-digit enrollment growth. And matter of fact, our residence halls are at 100%, and we have students that live off campus in apartments because we cannot house them on campus. But and we have waiting lists. And so one of the areas that we're seeking funding for is our main administration and academic building. It holds about 90% of all of our classes, 90% of all of our faculty officers that are there, and 90% of all of our administrative services in this building. This is the Henry Givens Academic Administrative Building. So why is that important? Because basically, because of our increased enrollment, we're strapped with space.
Mm-hmm.
And what's really special about our administration building is that it was a former Vashon High School. It's a high school. It's coming up on its 100th anniversary. It was built in 1923. And it was part of the old Mill Creek neighborhood. People from St. Louis know about the Mill Creek. So Mill Creek is one of the oldest, was one of the oldest communities in St. Louis. And during the 1950s, during this whole notion of urban renewal, the city raised the entire neighborhood. It was the largest urban renewal project in the country at the time. And so thousands of people were displaced. Hundreds of businesses, churches were leveled. But the only couple of buildings that remained was the Vashon High School. And so it's special to the community. It's historically significant, but that's our main administration building. But it's need of innovation, need of repair, and that's what we're trying to get funded for that in order for us to grow as an institution.
Hmm. Dr. Smith, you face some unique challenges there. If I understand correctly, your faculty is largely part-time. What kind of challenge does that pose for you and your students?
Well, I would say that at any institution, you want full-time faculty members because they are connected to the institution. And I would say this, that we have a tremendous adjunct pool, and we're fortunate because we're in St. Louis that we can pull upon some of the top professionals. You know, these are individuals who are working in a career, but they choose to connect to Harris Stowe because of our mission and what we provide to students. I've said it before that our adjunct pay is very low, and so individuals, they don't come to Harris Stowe to make a quick buck, but they're here for the opportunity to serve this population, this
distinct population.
They believe
in the cause, yeah.
They believe in the mission. However, we shouldn't be an institution that will constantly rely on part-time faculty members.
Mm-hmm.
Our goal is to increase the number full-time because that impacts retention, it
sure.
impacts persistence, it impacts graduation.
That's Dr. Dwayne Smith. He's the interim president at Harris Stowe State University over in St. Louis. Dr. Smith, thanks for sharing your views. I sure appreciate it.
You're welcome, and thank you for having me again.
You bet. Coming up, Brian and Spencer with your weekend to-do list. Well, look who's here, Brian McTavish. He follows and writes about pop culture. With him, Spencer Hardwick, founder and curator of Wire KC Weekender. They talk to us each week about fun stuff to do in your weekends. Gentlemen, welcome back.
Welcome back to us as well. Yes,
great to be with you, Steve.
Dweezil Zappa here. Tell us about that, Brian.
Dweezil Zappa. Yes, indeed. The guitar whiz son of avant-garde composer guitarist Frank Zappa.
That's putting it nicely, avant-garde, about Frank Zappa.
Yeah, that is kind of the nice way of putting
it.
Wasn't he the guy that warned us in song not to eat the yellow snow?
I think that'd be right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, you might even get to hear that 8 o'clock Saturday night at the Truman downtown when Dweezil Zappa
son of Frank, performs his late great father's classic 1969 album Hot Rats in the original track sequence, plus some other oddball faves by good old groundbreaking dad. Since 2006, Dweezil has been fronting touring bands that perform dad's music with the overall intent of sharing it with a younger generation, Spencer. That includes you, I think. You might make it out there. Check. although, speaking for myself and other nameless others, old fogies are also welcome to get into the quirky grooves of such numbers as Peaches and Regalia, which we're enjoying right now, or Willie the Pimp, or Son of Mr. Green Jeans, or It Must Be a Camel. Those tracks are among the ones that will be heard Saturday at the Truman. Dweezil has recorded extensively over the years, often in a supporting role, although his debut album at age 12, produced by rock star guitarist Eddie Van Halen. So this guy's been rubbing shoulders and elbows and kneecaps with lots of famous people. One more little thing. Dweezil's, in 1977, he had the guitar solo on Pat Boone's cover of Deep Purple's Smoke on the Water. So,
wow.
That would be something to request.
Wrap your arms around that one for
Saturday at the Truman, Dweezil.
Way down among Brazilians, coffee beans grow by the billions, so they've got to find those extra cups to fill. They've got an awful lot of coffee in Brazil. You can't get cherry soda because they've got...
Okay, we're talking coffee. I get it, Frank.
Absolutely. Now, how long has the coffee shop been this institution where people go and meet? It seems like over the past 15, 20 years, or maybe it's just that's when I reached adulthood, people are always meeting at coffee shops. Has that always been the case?
I don't drink coffee, so you're asking the wrong guy.
I drink too much coffee, but to me, and I'm making a leap perhaps, but to me it was the record shop.
Okay, well yeah, so we now know that coffee is the great meetup spot for a lot of people. So this is a particular event called the Business of Coffee, where you can join owners and operators of some of the city's best coffee shops to talk about what's going on, where is the coffee industry headed? We're talking about names like The Legend, Thou Mayest, Café Corazon, Blip Roasters, Barista de Casa, are just a taste, pun intended, of what you can expect to get from some of our best coffee.
Where is the coffee business headed?
This is a great place to figure it out. So we'll know it Friday at 7 p.m. I actually am not 100% sure. It was headed for Howard Schultz having a campaign run. That didn't last too long.
I'm always amazed at seeing cars lined up around the block at Starbucks, people waiting half an hour for a cup of coffee.
It's a mania.
I just can't believe it.
Sometimes I think they're giving away gold and not selling coffee. It's odd.
You wonder sometimes.
So this is Friday, 7 p.m. to 10 p.m., Woodneath Library Center, 89th Northeast Flintlock.
All right.
Oh, the day I was born, the nurses all gathered round. They gazed in wide wonder at the joy they had found. The head nurse spoke up, said, "Leave this one alone." She could tell right away that I was bad to the bone.
You know, the band that cut that album is going to be here this weekend.
Yes.
Reason to Live, number 463.
Oh, are you up to 463?
Yes, I am.
Okay, well, I'll try to keep up. Okay. Yes,
George Thorogood.
And let's not forget his Destroyers, the standard bearer for Meat and Potatoes Boogie Blues, 8 o'clock Sunday, Uptown Theater. More than a few seats still available, so I urge all the Boogie Blues fans out there.
Does he still sound like that?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, how hard is it to sound like that?
Yeah, well, okay.
Slap me. Okay. He sold 15 million albums. That's terrible, isn't it? He's played 8,000 concerts, all pretty much sounding about the same, in the last 45 years.
Wow.
He's still going strong. Okay, let's see. What can I tell you that you don't already know? That's his big tune, Bad to the Bone.
Oh, that was a big song.
That was the big one. He's been around since 74. He was a Rounder Records guy. He got a major label deal. Along the way, he hooked up with Budweiser, which isn't too surprising since he does a fantastic cover of John Lee Hooker's popular 1966 version of One Bourbon, One Scotch, and One Beer. Covers have been a big part of his success. He nails Bo Diddley's Who Do You Love. He does a rip-roaring version of Hank Williams' Moving On Over. And George is always, always great with a Chuck Berry tune like Reelin' and Rockin', or my favorite, No particular place to go. Well, here's a place to go. George Thurgood and the Destroyers.
8 o'clock Sunday at the Uptown.
Day is today. 8 Sunday at the Uptown.
All right, Spencer, what do we got?
Yeah, so I picked Lenny Kravitz's Fly Away because I wanted something that symbolized escape. What are two ways people escape today? Some folks like yoga, some people like beer. Yeah. So the folks over at Rochester Brewery, you know,
are
going to
combine them both.
Exactly.
A lot
I'm into these splicing events. They're interesting. You know, there's something new, something hip. So Rochester Brewing is hosting a beer yoga night. So this is a brewery. I'm glad you mentioned Budweiser on the last event. They're bringing in a certified yoga instructor. Instructor, excuse me.
Sounds like you had a beer.
I only do root beer, so I'm out on that.
All right.
And so while you're doing a yoga class, you can be drinking a beer. So it's an interesting twist on two of America's new favorite pastimes. If you don't want to drink coffee, you can have a beer.
Friday night at the Rochester Brewing and Roasting Company on Washington Street, right?
Yep.
Okay, we're talking shoes here. That's the key word in that song.
I have never been to anything like HypeCon. HypeCon is where athletic shoe fans will gather en masse to buy, sell, trade, or if it was just me, gawk.
Wow.
At countless hype sneakers, noon to 7 Saturday at Hy-Vee Arena. Arena? In the Hy-Vee Arena, say that three times. In the West Bottoms. So,
a lot of soul searching there.
And you've had a beer. And you've had a beer. Or a root beer, I should say. Here's the thing. Lots of vendors, so many shoes. But if you're going, it costs $10 to get in. You, me, anyone can bring in 5 pairs of super cool sneakers to sell or trade.
Wow.
But actually, that's 6 pairs if you count the ones you're walking in the place with.
Wow.
Actually, the sneaker resale business has been a highly profitable endeavor for some years. You know, maybe 4, even 5-figure amounts. So good luck out there in Sneakerville, HypeCon this weekend.
And finally today. I should have been a cowboy. I should have learned to rope and run. Wearing my 6-shooter, riding my pony on a cat and drive. Stealing a young girl. That's Toby Keith.
It sure is. And if you don't like sneakers, I'm sure you might like cowboy boots. The PBR Professional Bull Riders Association is hosting a huge bull riding contest this weekend at the Sprint Center. On Friday night, they'll have an event preceding that.
Why would anybody do that?
Oh, well, for $1 million on the line, that's one big reason.
Oh, wow.
So lace up your
$1 million
and get down to the Sprint Center all weekend for bull riding.
That's the world we live in. Okay,
absolutely.
Great list. Spencer Hardwick, Brian McTavish, thank you both very much.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
I had a great conversation yesterday with KU's legendary basketball coach, Marion Washington. You can find it and other episodes of Up to Date. Just go to kcur.org/up to date. Friday on the show, the League of Women Voters is 100 years old. My mom was once a proud member. We'll find out how they plan to celebrate. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Chelsea Engstrom. You can find and follow us on Twitter. Just go to KCUR, at KCUR, up to date. You can also follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.